The way that we use data now, given the immense amount and also types of data that we can buy, we can collect and scrape, and the technology, the intersection of technology now to be able to process that really fast, really smart and cheaply, accurately, you know, we are in at such a beautiful time to be alive because we can suddenly make better decisions with data. So I've always been around data, right? But I love the idea of smart cities because it's about bringing smart technology with people to make better decisions. It's not just technology, it's people and tech. It's combining data with people. It's combining art and science. It's combining creativity with analytical thinking.
Hi, Smart Community friends. In this episode of the Smart Community Podcast, I have a really brilliant chat with Alisa Choi, an economist and a data strategist and the founder of Maven Data. We talk about Alisa's background in data and strategy and her passion for making better decisions with data, as well as why it's important to the smart community space. Alisa tells us what Maven Data does and shares some really interesting examples of some of their research and insights, such as around the COVID vaccine in Australia, racism in Australia, and also global wellness trends. We talk about the way data can help us predict trends and behaviour change, and what local governments can learn from the insights from Maven Data, as well as bringing traditional research methods, new market data insights, and key stakeholders together to have better conversations. We finish our chat discussing the emerging trends of questioning existing systems and challenging the status quo, particularly with regards to the rise of women's voices and diversity and discrimination in general. For a little bit of context, we actually recorded this episode on the 5th of March, 2021. And in this episode, Alisa actually predicts the female roar, the rise of the female roar. She says that her insights show that we were so angry. We hated the patriarchy. What were we going to do about it? And she was questioning why we hadn't done anything about it. So we had a really interesting conversation about that. Now, lo and behold, on March 15th, the Women's March for Change happened here in Australia. So it's predicted here first, the rise of the female voice or the female roar, predicted here by Alisa Choi. Now, as always, we hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
Welcome to the smart community, smart regions, smart towns, and smart cities. It's where we live, work, and play. With smart communities, the future starts today. Big data, smart mobility, emerging trends galore. The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.
Hello, Alisa. How are you today?
I'm well, Zoe. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm really excited to have you on the podcast. So let's just jump straight in. And can you tell us about your background and what you're passionate about?
My background. Okay, so I guess it's very unconventional and a bit of a choose your own adventure, because at times they weren't my adventures chosen to me. I've been, a generalist across many industries and many different roles. But always the through line has been data, strategy, and outcomes, commercial outcomes. So I spent 8 years in finance, banking, consulting, and then the GFC hit in 2009. So I completely pivoted and I spent the next 8 years in marketing, insights, analytics, and retail. And then it was time for me to leave the corporate cage because this bird needed to fly and spread her wings, as we all feel sometimes. And so, now I run my own business. It's a market research company called Maven Data. And so, yeah, I'm passionate really about smart decision making using the resources that we have available. And there's vast amount of resources, not only just data, but technology. And I absolutely, absolutely detest ignorance and arrogance in all forms. So when we don't know what we don't know, that's where, you know, wisdom comes from, the power of using data and the ability to make better decisions and having the humility to accept that we just don't know everything that's out there. So that's what I love. Making better decisions with data.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that you love that, but I also love that too, that we can use data to make better decisions. And sometimes it's in really exciting areas, but sometimes it's really in quite mundane areas, but it makes it exciting because we can get insights that we never thought were possible.
That's right. So we just can't assume that we know everything. You may be an expert in an industry, which is great context, but we are surrounded by a constant sea of change and we collect data about this change. And the world that I work in is online, you know, so I call that the market data. In navigating markets, you need to look outside what you know, whether you collect it in your business or what you know in your head, you got to look at the market data around you.
Absolutely. Well, let's jump into what sparked your interest. And I normally ask what sparked your interest in smart community space, but tell us about smart city space, but also how you got into data in the first place.
I've always been in data, I guess, financial data, business data, stuff we collect, financial information, business information. So I've always been trained, all of us actually, whether you're an accountant or a lawyer, everything is data-based. But the way that we use data now, given the immense amount and also types of data that we can buy, we can collect and scrape, and the technology, the intersection of technology now to be able to process that really fast, really smart and cheaply, accurately, you know, we are in at such a beautiful time to be alive because we can suddenly make better decisions with data. So I've always been around data, right? But I love the idea of smart cities because it's about bringing smart technology with people to make better decisions. It's not just technology. It's people and tech. It's combining data with people. It's combining art and science. It's combining creativity with analytical thinking. So I'm so excited to be part of this podcast today because smart cities brings all these concepts together. And so we can change the world one bite at a time.
Love it. So what is a smart community to you?
To me, I think it's the use of technology, as I said, and the immense resources in market data available around us. And why is that important? Well, to truly conduct smart research on sentiment in an unbiased way, which is my game at Maven Data, you know, it's important to listen to the market to better understand their needs, better understand their pain points. So when you're talking smart community, right, we want people to be heard. And part of that is through market data. And the lens that we use is AI. So the traditional methods of surveys, polls, and focus groups, they're no longer really relevant for the big economic, strategic, community-based questions. Like, you know, if you had to survey a few thousand people on whether, like, for example, taking the COVID vaccine is the right method, well, it's like surveying a few thousand people on what they think and feel about this massive multifaceted issue that impacts our community. Like, it's the wrong method. It's like if I wanted to test the temperature of the ocean, right, a survey or a poll or focus group would just be like taking three buckets of water out of the sea and then making these big extrapolations representing the market. That's not the way research can be done now. It's, you know, so for me, smart community, there's an opportunity for us to make these better decisions that impact the community by listening to the community more through these better methods.
Let's just dive straight into what it is that Maven Data does, and then we can go into some of the projects that you've been working on.
So Maven Data, we are the world's first strategic market research agency that's powered by AI. So we look at measuring market sentiment and emotion because we know that people make decisions through emotions, and we know that strong emotions actually change behavior. So put it this way, if you love something or you hate something, it's a strong feeling. You're more likely to do something, change your behavior, than if you sort of merely kind of go, oh, yeah, that's all right, or, oh, that's kind of annoying me. You know, that doesn't change behavior. So when we do market sentiment analysis and measuring emotions, we can uncover what people deeply care about. And when we come up with things where we're measuring emotions and intensity of emotions, and we measure a whole raft of things, when we see that we can predict changes in human behavior, that becomes a trend that will change the market. That's when we say we predict the future. So the types of things we apply this to are, it's basically anything to do with consumers and moving markets, right? So anywhere from brands to marketing to strategy to opportunities to risk, but also we're starting to look at more economic, social policy and public policy issues like the smart community type topics. So we're currently going to start a project on COVID vaccine rollout. So with the University of Sydney, we're looking at what's the sentiment of the market, not a survey of a few thousand people. We're looking at the entire population of Australia who engages with content online on this topic, and we're going to be measuring the sentiment towards it. And it's unbiased, because when we measure and analyze people surfing the internet, what content they engage with, the millions of behavioral interactions online, we can all of a sudden get a very good view of how people care. Do they even care? I'm pretty sure they care. But for this topic, how do they feel about it? Do they want it or are they against it? So the implications of this research, for example, is that, one, we have a connection between leaders and policymakers, right, who are responsible for taking carriage of this big task, right? We're connecting them to the market and doing it in real time and monitoring it over time. Because at the moment, people are making decisions on whether to take it or not. It's very personal. We need to uncover what are those elements or attributes or drivers of choice. And that's the stuff that we do. That's just one example, Zoe, of many things.
Yeah, and I know you talk about being unbiased. Is there I'm just going to ask you this maybe dumb question, but is there a bias on the people that actually engage on the internet? Like, are they the people that either hate it or that love it? Whereas how do you capture the people like me, where I might read an article and then I read the next article? Like, I don't engage, but maybe I'm engaging by clicking on the article, I suppose. But yeah, how do you capture those people?
Okay. So when we talk about the market, right, when we're researching, say, COVID vaccine sentiment, we're literally looking at all the content that people as a cohort in any country, in any language, engage with. We don't actually know who you are or where you live. We don't go down to the individual. That's not the level that we go down to. We're at the strategic level. The question we can answer is, anybody who is engaging or interested in, or, you know, like you, on this topic, it's a selected market by self-selecting who you are. It's like you're interested in it. So through that, then we can pick up, well, what are these people reading? What are they sharing? What are they commenting on? And it's everything online. So it could be a blog. It could be a website. It could be a social media platform. Everything outside a firewall, right? So by nature, that is the sample through self-selection of that topic of people. And from there, then we can gauge, okay, based on the content, we can then understand the emotions and the contextualization of that topic online. And that's where we get the view of market sentiment.
Mm-hmm. And you've been doing some work in the wellness space as well, which obviously is a huge, and I mean, I guess it's changing. And I guess that's what some of the data's telling us as well. But like, can you share some insights into what you've been doing in the wellness space?
Yes, global wellness is a mega theme. So what that means is it's worth $4.5 trillion, right? And it crosses so many industries relevant to our lives. So when we took this study, it took 14 months to analyze and test all the expert opinions and trends on what's going to move and shape wellness. We tested that against the market globally in English, and we uncovered 10 transformational trends, which are going to change the world based on, as I said, measuring emotions, measuring engagement, finding out the ones that are actually going to move the needle where people can change their behavior. So, you know, the six industries we covered, like they're everyday industries, like food and nutrition, right? So we looked at, you know, themes like keto, paleo, we looked at gut health, we looked at all these things, which were the ones that really resonated and are meaningful. And we looked at healing, we looked at health, we looked at travel and tourism, home design and lifestyle, and beauty. So across those six, we found 10 transformational trends that are predicted to change the world. And one of them I'm happy to share with you today is that gut health and wellness are very well connected. And you know that, you know, gut health and wellness has been around for a long time. It's not new, but it's about whether the market's ready to engage. That's where we provide the insights for brand marketers, to strategists, to business owners, you know, to business planning. You know, what are the opportunities? Because that is a tidal wave of opportunity coming your way. So you need to prepare your surfboard and ride it. So that's what we hone in on. So we have a world first inaugural predictions report suite that's available through Maven Data, which covers 200 of these trends, and we've tested them all. Not everything's relevant, right? And some of the stuff that's like, you know, sugar-free, it's not relevant anymore. Fat-free, not relevant anymore, right? So that means don't focus your marketing, don't build products around that. People don't care anymore, right? So it gives people a way to navigate this constancy of change. And wellness is a huge opportunity. It's a mega trend, as I said. It'll be here to stay for years to come. So we've already seen some of our insights play out in market, particularly with gut health and wellness. So, you know, we've seen that not only is it transformational, but we've got data that says that, you know, one product line in a major supermarket chain in Australia, which is kombucha, which is related to gut health, it's just fermented tea, that as a beverage has achieved over 10% sales growth in the last 52 weeks. Now, if you put it in perspective, to achieve 10% sales growth in a beverage category, and beverages, we don't drink more or less beverages, we just switch between different beverages, right? So a beverage category in the grocery or supermarket, it's pretty stable. It's pretty stable. So when you had a, when you've got a 10.9% increase in sales for one line that plays along the gut, well, gut health and wellness theme, that is pretty much proof in the pudding that we've predicted the market.
Yeah, so interesting. And I've heard you talk about the kombucha story before, because I was thinking, you know, my mum used to make kombucha like, what, 20, 30 years ago. And people were like, oh, who, like, you're crazy. You know, what's going on here? And then my sister and I also used to make kombucha with the SCOBY and all that stuff and whatever. And then it just started getting, and, you know, so we'd drink it and, you know, you try and feed it to your friends and they're like, oh, what is this? Yeah. Then it's just, it's crazy that you can buy it. People are mixing it with gin, and it's surprising that, yeah, it's in mainstream markets, but, like, you know, it's now consumable, it's everywhere, it's normal, whatever. And yet now you get it from, yeah, I guess Woolies and that type of thing, but also it's a replacement for soft drink. If you go into a cafe, you don't want to drink coffee, you'll have a kombucha or whatever. So I found it really fascinating when you were talking about that. But also, I guess some of the health aspects are obviously lost in it when you're doing this mass production of things, something else I was thinking about, not necessarily data, but we don't seem to care so much about that. We're just like, oh no, we want kombucha. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with this, but it's more like, then where does it then, it must drop off at some point where you go, oh, this isn't actually adding anything more. So I guess you're looking at the data and then creating insights into, well, what's the next thing that's going to come out?
Yeah. The markets always move. So something that could be in now could be not tomorrow. Like back in the day, sugar-free was the biggest thing. All the advertising was around 99% fat-free or sugar-free. Now people don't care. What we're seeing across particularly the food narratives that we tested was that people are ready for the science. So they're ready to elevate the conversation. We're not just talking about the five food groups anymore, which is wrong, by the way. I'm just looking at nutrition. We're actually looking at the science of food and nutrition and how it impacts our health. And we see this crossover across into the beauty segment, because people are now interested in understanding the science of beautiful skin, the science of glowing skin. It's not about just covering up your blemishes. There's another theme that crosses over, saying being yourself. We need to be proud of being who ourselves are, you know. So it means warts and all, whatever. And beauty comes from within. So when I look at markets, when we do research of this nature, we always see the interconnectivity of these major life themes. You know, health is not different to healing, not different to food. They're all interrelated. And that's where I guess the magic of what we see translated into actionable strategies is really powerful now that we can use data and technology.
And I don't mean to go back to kombucha, but I'm just thinking, like, you know, in, I don't know, maybe 5-10 years ago, it would have been, this is a low sugar drink, right? This is no sugar, low sugar. Whereas now the branding is, it's exactly the same thing, but it's gut health. And so that's what you're talking about here. And some things that, you know, definitely things that we don't even notice until we start looking into it. And even on the beauty side of things, it's like, yeah, before it was like brightening or whatever, whereas now it's like natural. This is organic or whatever. I guess organic must be a huge one that you're looking at too at the moment.
Yeah, there's just generally a conscious awareness of where food comes from, how things are made, not only the source materials, but also the processes as well. We're seeing that come through. So it's like from a smart community perspective or a smart city perspective, everyone's elevating their consciousness at some level of time, and it's translating in very specific themes that we see play out. You know, so food is one example, but beauty is definitely another one. Health and wellness is another one. But when you think about travel and tourism, it was interesting that that industry needs to reimagine, right? So, and what I mean by that is, like, the way that travel and tourism and hospitality is presented, some are winning, some are losing. Those that are winning are actually able to repackage their offering, create a destination experience. It's not just about, you know, nice sheets and standard hotel rooms and all that. It's more than that now. So I see, particularly with the travel and tourism segment, there's so many opportunities to connect to these other wellness trends because they need to be reimagined. It's a high capital, high cost business. It employs so many people in the economy, right? In hospitality, in tourism, yeah. And yes, at the moment, we're all locked down from international travel with a little bit of interstate, but this is actually the best time to strategize and prepare for when doors open again. And when doors open again, if you're not at top of mind, if you're not engaging consumers now, you've missed the boat.
I'm really keen to go to, you know, in the smart community space, lots of government involvement, obviously industry, small business, I mean, kind of touches everybody. But I think from a local government perspective, what are some of the things that they could think about from the insights that you draw?
So I suppose politics is one interesting element, right? Because politics are there to serve their constituents at a federal, state and local level, right? So one area that I think is an opportunity is, as I said, connecting leaders and decision makers closer to the market, which means having access to market data. So in the context of smart communities and local governments, et cetera, there is definitely smart research that you can do to uncover what are the pain points, what are the issues. You know, they currently do a lot of town halls or someone can write into their local member, you know, but really amplifying that process by taking a look at the issues around the community, because who knows, it might be that we all think that this particular issue is an issue, but when we test it, it's not. There's something that might pop up that we didn't even know was an issue, but until you test it, you don't know. So it gives you focus and clarity on what's important for the market, however you define it, and that gives you an opportunity to engage and be relevant. We're in the business of helping businesses remain relevant, including governments, because if you're not relevant, people don't care.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's a key point too, the relevancy of things and of business, but then, yeah, now government. And particularly I'm thinking like from a local government perspective, I talk to a lot of different local governments and or I talk to a lot of different communities as well. And, you know, some people I'll talk to and they don't even really know what the local government does other than pick up their things and stuff and I don't even know where to get information about this and that. Whereas others that are engaging with their community, then oh yeah, have a look at their website. They've got all this stuff about smart cities, blah, 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 blah. I think it's so important and it really changes the way that you can engage with your community. And I know you're talking about that the older way of, you know, having those town halls and things. I still see that there's a place for those things, right? To engage directly with the community and particularly for people that aren't on the internet, I think would be, you know, something useful. But I can see where you can understand the market and bring those things together. It can't be one or the other, right?
Correct. In fact, part of the process we run in doing any research piece is actually bringing together key stakeholders in that conversation. So, for example, you know, we would be looking at, if you're looking at smart cities, we'd be testing a whole bunch of narratives around what people think smart cities even is. Do they even know it exists and what does it mean to them? And, you know, what we'd also be doing is bringing in the insights or the opinions of people gathered through town halls and other various methods when how they engage with their community. We'd be testing those. So it's really bringing together traditional research methods or collections of information together, and we're now overlaying it with the power of testing it against a wider market in an unbiased way.
Mm. And I know some of your other work was about Australians and racism. Can you share any insights on that? Because obviously it's a very important and a huge topic, particularly coming out of 2020.
Yeah, so this was part of a study we did late last year around migration into Australia as a topic. So I've been working with a professor at the University of Sydney who's an expert in migration. So she's provided the context around what I should be testing. And the main question was, what does the world think of in terms of migrating to Australia? Do they care about Australia? Do they not care about Australia? And we looked at it from many angles, migrating to Australia from an education standpoint, health system standpoint, government standpoint, job opportunities, and racism. And we looked at it from multiple languages. So we chose five of the major community languages spoken in Australia, and we did it outside in. So what did the Indian English speakers in India think about Australia? What did the Chinese Mandarin speakers? What did the Spanish speakers? What did the Arabic speakers? And what did Vietnamese, right? So from that, it was really interesting. And what we saw was that out of all the community languages, only one came out as interested in migrating to Australia right now, right? And it's the Indian. English-speaking Indians. Now, when you look at it from a policies perspective, that has huge implications because I think a lot of people would assume that the Chinese would still find Australia attractive, you know, maybe even the Spanish-speaking, right? But we didn't see that. It was the Indian English speakers. And then when we looked at racism, it was very interesting to see that we looked at, well, the question was, do you think Australia's racist, right? Now, imagine asking that in a survey or a poll. Do you think people will tell you the truth? Probably. So in this view, we found that certain countries did find Australia racist. However, was it important in understanding their decision about coming to Australia? Some countries not. So we found that Indians did find Australia attractive, but and racism was an issue, but was prevalent, but it wasn't so much of an issue. So they're used to it, unfortunately, right? So that was an interesting insight. We also found that Australians within Australia do recognise that we are racist.
So interesting. And I think to be able to ask some of those questions that you're not allowed to ask, I think is really key to finding some of those really deep insights, right? And also, what does it mean for the market, for politics, for, you know, our economy, all those things? Like, it's not just, oh, yeah, now we know that, great, tick the box. It's, okay, well, what does that actually mean? What are the things that what do we need to shift? What do we need to focus on, change, et cetera, et cetera? I think that's, really, really interesting.
Yeah, it's one thing to find information out like this. The next thing is how do you take it into a meaningful outcome? And I think the first step to a meaningful outcome is having the right information, right? Having the right insight. And so with this sort of information, I mean, like, it's now taking the opinion out of a boardroom conversation or a group of people. It's now saying this has been tested and validated as one, important or not, and two, this is how people feel about it. Three, we can tell you why. You know, what's the story behind shaping this narrative? And four, we also find that we're also looking at voices of power and influence in any conversation, meaning that for racism in Australia, you know, there are certain websites and certain people that are part of that conversation. So strategically, then you think, well, how am I going to mobilise an outcome? Well, there's already these known voices of power, we call, which in which case there's an audience that's already engaged in this. And then you become focused on how you work with them to either shift the message, turn it around, or be part of the conversation.
So interesting. Okay. Well, that kind of leads quite nicely into emerging trends. Obviously, you talk about you must live and breathe emerging trends. So what are the emerging trends that people aren't talking about enough?
Okay. I am glad you asked this question. It's actually very topical, given the current time we are recording this conversation. So some of the emerging trends I see across all the different studies that we've done for clients and industry are, obviously, there's the rise of the woman's voice. There is a questioning and challenging of the existing system of politics, system of corporate, system of economy. We are seeing that play out in a number of narratives we've tested, which have very strong, what we call timeless, deeply relevant and engaging classification with emotion. So we've looked at misogyny, patriarchy, white supremacy, Me Too. We've looked at women in leadership. We've looked at a lot of different things. And so one, I'd say, overarching community, society, emerging theme I'm seeing is that it's the challenge of the status quo of what's happened over the last 200 years, the way the system and politics around the world have moved and shaped how we lived and worked, right? So the disturbing thing I see in this research is that things like even workplace bullying, when I looked at this 2 years ago, when I see emotions, it's deeply, intensely negative, as in people are really upset, really, really upset. And I see that from the colours of an emotion wheel, right? When I tested it again last year, again, same story, deeply emotional, deeply red. And then I see it again now with patriarchy, same thing, deep emotional red. It's very rare you see that, but it's disturbing to me because we accept it. We've accepted this pain, this condition for so long. And then it makes me think, why did we accept it for so long? Because the theory is that if people feel very strongly emotively about something, they're going to change their behavior, right? But I'm not seeing the change in behavior happen in markets. So I'm like, questioning myself, I don't know what you think about this, Zoe. I mean, like, you know, if we really hate something so much, we hate bullying so much, we hate patriarchy so much, we hate white supremacy so much, why are we not seeing action? there's a disconnect between the ability to act and how we feel. I haven't figured that out yet, but maybe now's the time.
Is it the power? Is it the, you know, you were talking about the voices and the power. It's that there's not enough people, there's not enough diversity behind the, I used to say behind the code, so we can deal with it in front of the code, but actually it's not enough diversity within the power, and it's changing, it's definitely shifting. But until we have that kind of real reflection of our actual communities in power and in leadership, that's when we'll see the real action, real change. So it'll be really interesting. I don't have all the answers, but I do spend a lot of time thinking about it, particularly being in engineering and that type of thing. But I remember talking to a doctor about being a woman in engineering, and she couldn't relate to me because she's like, oh, that's not how it is in medicine. We're equal. And I was like, oh, wow, how did that happen? And whether that's true or not, but that was just her reaction to it. I thought that was really interesting because, you know, I don't know what the statistics are, but 50-50 potentially, I'm not sure, but that power shift or the power dynamic wasn't there in her opinion. So I thought that was really fascinating because we could look to other industries, particularly, you know, we're talking about STEM and data and those type of things, having more diversity behind the code. What is it about medicine that attracts certain people there and the creative, the, you know, women, whatever it is, whoever we're looking at, what attracts them there and not attracts them to engineering or data or whatever? So it's actually about changing that narrative.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? I don't have the answer, but I think when I think about, look, we've all experienced bullying in our lifetime, we have, or some sort of discrimination in our life, particularly as women, right? So it's like you kind of get used to it, but you hate it. That's what we've picked up on. Like, it's part of society. Yes, we bloody hate it. But I think now when you think about emerging trends, the rise of the female roar, there's the help of social media, which allows us to connect with like-minded people who have the same lived experience, so you're not alone. There's the elevation and recognition that this is a worthy conversation, you know, like the likes of the Australians of the Year in 2021. Those are little signals that for all of us to say, you know what, we do have the right to have a voice and be who we are. And there's mechanisms now, like we never had mechanisms before because we didn't have social media. We couldn't put our views out there to share our views with the world. So, and it also makes things accountable. So all the bad behaviors in the past, it's like now there's a mechanism to actually bring it to the forefront and have a conversation. So I think we're at this very interesting precipice of change, and the voice of the female roar is going to come through stronger and stronger. And it's actually very, it's coming through the younger generation, right? You look at your Greta Thunbergs. When we looked at, we predicted the rise of Greta Thunberg back in January 2018 because we were looking at climate change. If you remember casting your eye, back to three years ago, people were still debating, oh, is it a myth? Is it this? And like, is it the science? Is it whatever? Is it political? Back then, we picked up on the fact that there was a groundswell of momentum amongst young people. And then you had 15 months later, in March 2019, in Australia, 40,000 school children, like, protest, leave school and protest for climate change. And then 6 more months in September 19, we had Greta Thunberg and the global climate change strike, when 400,000 people in Australia, like, walked the streets. So it's the young generation who goes, you know what, I'm going to have a voice. I have a mechanism to shout my voice out. And they're braver than we ever were when we were that age. So I think it's the emerging trend is that we are challenging the system and we hate it so much. So given the sentiment around it, there's not going to be much momentum required. You just need a mechanism. You need an enabler. And I think it's about individual ownership of the action and issue. You don't have to wait for a government to put out some big policy or a corporate policy. You can take action yourself every single day.
Yes. And I think that's true while you're talking there. It's the tool, right? Like, younger people have given the tools, but not just like, you know, social media or whatever it is. They've actually been given the tools mentally to know that they can make a difference, right? Like, you know, and I think, you know, I was always told that I could do whatever I wanted to do. And I believed that. And then I went and did it. And particularly I grew up in a regional area. I didn't know that, you know, girls weren't engineers, you know, or very little, there wasn't many. And so I didn't realize that there was this thing, this, you know, I just went, and then I went to uni and went, oh, I'm one of, I don't know, what, 20%, one of five, not even that. I was, it's probably less than that, but I was like, okay, this is a thing. But then I didn't realize that what the consequences of that were was that I was different, because I was always different and I actually really enjoyed being different, whereas I couldn't understand when people didn't, until you get discriminated against because you're different and you're like, oh, okay, what's happening here? And then, of course, you know, coming from a background where, you know, there was only a small amount of difference and not a huge amount of difference, that the discrimination, you know, the scale just goes up and up, right? And I can't imagine, because I've never been in a situation where I've been discriminated against because of the color of my skin and those type of things as well, which is horrendous and awful. And I think those type of things we definitely are saying no to, but we know still happen, and what are we going to do about it? And I also think there's a link between that and smart communities, in the sense that, like you were just saying, that people now can say, no, I don't agree with that. And the transparency is something that I think smart communities can bring, and the trust that that will bring as well. And it's a long game. It's not going to happen tomorrow. And I think, like you were saying, like with climate change, like, oh, is it real? Is it not real? I don't know. What's going on over? And now we're going, oh, science. Okay, cool. That's, you know, we're going to actually do something. What are we going to do about this now? I think similarly with, you know, technology and data and those type of things, you know, it's like, oh, no, I'm, you know, it's like, oh, no, that's not going to affect me. That's not going to change anything. You know, we've done it this way. That stuff is now shifting. And then we're having more mature conversations. I shouldn't say more mature. We're having more advanced conversations about what does that mean for me and my privacy, and not just my privacy, because I, you know, I live in a house and, you know, I have an income, those type of things. What does that mean for people that don't have another choice, that they can't get out of the system because they have to live and breathe it every day? So now I'm ranting and TED talking, but I think it's really important to link those things together. And then it'll be really interesting to see what those trends start to be moving out of this, for sure.
Yeah, fascinating. I have such a privilege to see all this interconnectivity, because everything's related. So, you know, women is related to leadership, which is related to our individual psyche, which is related to community, which is related to how we treated each other. It's related eventually to the economy in the end. So I'm very excited and hopeful. We are in this generation of change. And what I want is just to have the right data-driven approach to take the opinions away, and so we have the same level playing field to which you look at an issue, identify whether it is an issue and why. That gives you at least a chance to know, to steer it towards the outcome. Other than at the moment, gas bagging, oh, I think this, I think this, I think this, I think this. It's like, no, let's just test this and have a clear focused path forward. And then if we don't achieve the outcome, then that's another issue. But at least as a starting point, having a data-driven approach.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, and we're going to wrap up soon because we've run over time, but I think people, even just data-driven approach will be business as usual, because it has to be, because it's the only accurate way to do things properly. And I think when we say data-driven, for some people that's, oh, you know, that's technology and whatever. It's not. Like you just said, you've always dealt with data from the beginning of your career. I've always dealt with data, but I didn't really think about it like that until I got into data and went, oh, of course, you know, this is all data. Everyone deals with data all day, every day. And so we're dealing with it now. So how can we make, particularly for, you know, a government or a business or whatever, how can we make better decisions with the data we already have? And what should we do about that? And not just because we can, what should we do? Which is those more mature conversations around privacy, ethics, all those type of things. We need to weave that in, but data's not going away. It's actually getting more and more. So, okay. Well, that was great. Thank you so much. And I know we're running over time, so I want to let you go. So last question, how can people connect with you?
We have an ecosystem online. So you can connect with me through our website, mavendata.com.au, subscribe to our newsletters, and you'll share interesting tidbits and thought bubbles. We can also connect through our socials, so LinkedIn and also YouTube channel. We've got lots of content there. And Instagram, if you're looking for a little bit of fun and flair on how we take our approach to data, you can go there as well.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Elisa, for coming onto the podcast. I really appreciate it and sharing your insights. And yeah, I look forward to catching up again soon.
Thank you so much.
Talk soon. Bye.
Bye.
Are you looking for an engaging speaker, MC, or facilitator for your next big event? Then we've got you covered. Zoe is a go-to speaker, MC, and conversation facilitator with a difference. She's a master at simplifying the complex and making connections you might never see. Book Zoe for your next event. Email hello@mysmart.community or head over to her speaker page, www.mysmart.community/speaking.
Thanks so much for listening to the Smart Community Podcast. Show notes for this episode and all other episodes are available on our website, mysmart.community/podcast. If you have any questions for us or any of our guests, you can email hello@mysmart.community. You can also find us on the socials. We are on LinkedIn and Twitter @smartcomhq. That's com with two M's. If you are enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe so you never miss an episode. And we would love for you to leave us a rating and review at wherever you listen. This really helps us reach more ears and eyes, so thank you for your support. As always, we hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed making it.
The Smart Community Podcast is what you're looking for.